From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Joe Biden in China, public pension cuts cleared in troubled Detroit and Illinois, and the world remembers Nelson Mandela. Yesterday, South African President Jacob Zuma announced Nelson Mandela's death at 95 on South African television.
Our nation has lost its greatest son. Our people have lost a father.
In Seoul, South Korea, Vice President Joe Biden said the U.S. military will ignore China's demand that planes flying over the East China Sea first notify Beijing.
We do not recognize the zone. It will have no effect on American operations. Just ask my general. None. Zero.
And in Detroit, a judge's municipal bankruptcy ruling opens pensions, public pensions, for cuts. Michael Anderson, a Detroit firefighter for 31 years, just retired, asked the question on the minds of many.
What is going to be the dent in the pension? You know, I've heard rumors from 20% to 50%, which could be devastating.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Gideon Rose of Foreign Affairs, David Shepherdson of the Detroit News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What are you thinking today on Nelson Mandela, on Biden and Beijing, Detroit pensions? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from New York today, Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. Gideon Rose, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
With us from Washington, David Shepherdson, Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. David, welcome back to you as well. Your city's in the news this week for sure.
Certainly. Hi, Tom.
Hi. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Gideon, and David.
Let's go straight to that voice that for so many years, decades, the world looked to for kind of high moral clarity. Here's Nelson Mandela. This was his inaugural speech. He became the first democratically elected black president of South Africa, 1994, Nelson Mandela.
We know it well that none of us acting alone can achieve success. We must therefore act together as a united people for national reconciliation, for nation building, for the birth of a new world.
The birth of a new world, Nelson Mandela in 1994, and last night, after news of his death at 95, here's President Obama.
Through his fierce dignity and unbending will to sacrifice his own freedom for the freedom of others, Madiba transformed South Africa and moved all of us. His journey from a prisoner to a president embodied the promise that human beings and countries can change for the better.
Jack Beatty, you watched Nelson Mandela rise and rise and rise in global esteem over the years, become this incredible icon, very few in that class, that tier. What was it about this man and his message, Jack?
Well, you know, I think President Obama put it well when he was in South Africa. He called him a hero for the world. That is somebody whose greatness transcended all the categories, certainly the categories of nation and race. And you know, to me, what's most striking about him is how he kept transcending himself. You'd expect him to be bitter and so, you know, and fiercely opposed to white rule, and indeed at some points in his life, he gave way to black nationalism. He comes out of prison a figure of reconciliation. He speaks of forgiveness. Even in his personal life, there's this transcending of moral righteousness into something like moral sympathy, his attitudes toward his second wife. When Mandela, as she descended into criminality and thuggery and so on, he couldn't judge because he recognized, as the obituary said, that in part, what had happened to her and his family was a result of his leaving the family to dedicate his life to politics, and he couldn't judge because he saw his own involvement in that. A man of an exquisitely fine moral compass.
Gideon Rose, we look at South Africa today, and the circumstances there are far from perfect, but when we look back at the absolute brutality, the cruelty of racial oppression under apartheid, what South Africa could have become, the bloodbath, civil war that was widely feared, and something quite different emerging under Nelson Mandela. That in itself, an incredible accomplishment.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a man who clearly is in the category of King, of Gandhi, of Vaclav Havel, who not only was a national resistance leader who brought his people and his country to freedom, but also then served as a kind of Cincinnatus who stepped down from power in a George Washington-like way, didn't turn into a tyrant, actually became even greater once he assumed power than he had been in the taking of it. In terms of the context of South Africa today, we can see the problems South Africa has, and they are real and multiple. But in some ways, it's the residue of the problems that were left behind once Mandela managed to solve the central and crucial problem, which was how can you actually construct a unified democratic polity without any kind of race war, without recrimination, and so forth. And in some ways, actually, it's the consequence of the strategy that he adopted to deal with those problems. He was a genius politician as well as a moral hero, and that's in some ways not been quite as appreciated because he's in some ways he was all things to all people. There were communists who wanted the end of capitalism. There were black nationalists who wanted an end to white rule. There were liberals who wanted democracy. And he managed to combine all those strands and in some ways not quite tell different stories to different people, but to construct a narrative that delegitimized the apartheid government by promising lots of different things. And in some ways, the questions about how South Africa would be governed below the level of great principle were kind of left unspecified until much later. And that's the kind of problems and challenges that people are grappling with now. They're not the deep principle ones. They're almost the technocratic leadership. The new Mandela today or the next Mandela wouldn't need to be a deep moral hero, would need to have good democratic and technocratic expertise and governance.
David Shepherdson, here was this man, Nelson Mandela, essential, central to South Africa, to the to all that unfolded after he got out of prison and apartheid was finally ended, central to that, and yet beyond it still, here's a moral hero to the whole world. I mean, I can't think of any other of his stature for years and years and years. Just the fact that such a man existed for many people far from South Africa, far from its trial, was a great inspiration.
Oh, I mean, I guess it's what's really remarkable is when you consider the dysfunction, the sort of general distrust, dislike of politicians, not just in the United States, but in many countries around the world where politicians are held in such low regard. He, you know, is now embraced by every member, basically, of every political party, not just the United States, but around the world. And he is one of those few rare transcendent figures who, if you look at his career, you know, oftentimes put aside ideology to focus on this one overriding goal. But it is also important to remember that, you know, in the United States in the early 1980s, the Reagan administration opposed Senate efforts on an anti-apartheid bill. So
yes,
he wasn't always the ANC and Mandela were not always embraced by the United States, which often looked at things through the Cold War prism and saw South Africa as a reliable anti-communist ally.
I mean, Gideon, that is very important to remember, that the United States officially was not on, fully on board the anti-apartheid bandwagon for a long time, even up into the Reagan administration's stiff resistance to sanctions and much more that Nelson Mandela and the ANC were calling for there. You know, it's easy to look back now and see the great lustrous hero, but for many years he was described by the South African white rulers as, I mean, he was convicted of treason. He was in prison for almost 30 years. His picture, his photograph could not even be shown in South Africa. His words could not be quoted in the South African press. And the United States government did not step up for a long time to take his side.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, a combination of factors. On the one hand, it was a need to deal with the devil that you had in front of you. And so there were somewhat legitimate strategic considerations. It was also a failure of moral vision to understand and actually stand up against the true evil that apartheid represented. And it was also a function of the fact that the greatness of the hero that Mandela ultimately proved himself to be was not always apparent. apparent. Remember, there were lots of national leaders leading national resistance movements who did not end up as great moral heroes. And so I think that the everybody, you know, what Nixon's famous comment that we're all Keynesians now, mm-hmm. We're all ANC supporters and Mandela worshipers now. It was not always clear and obvious that Mandela would be the Mandela that he turned out to be. And the people who, you know, opposed it have egg on their faces. There's actually a nice piece in National Review Online by DeRoy Murdoch, who's a friend of mine, who, you know, in effect, copping to that, saying, look, here's why I opposed him at the time, and here's why I was completely and totally wrong.
An important thing to remember right there. But if I may, Gideon, our clock is running toward a break here. I just want to get you in, Jack, because on the other side of that coin, there were many who stood up tall and forcefully against apartheid in this country, kind of taking the Mandela side early on. They deserve to be remembered today as well.
Absolutely. And in fact, it makes you wonder who's going – what things we're now making our peace with that will look ridiculous and appalling in retrospect down the road.
Jack?
Yes, and people whose names we've almost forgotten. Ron Dellums, for example, the congressman from Berkeley, was a huge figure in that fight. A preacher by the name of Sullivan, who gave his name to the Sullivan Protocols that set up the regime of sanctions. Tremendous, solidarity with Nelson Mandela. They kept the flame high here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, Biden in China, pensions and Detroit, a train off the rails, and the world remembers, honors Nelson Mandela. Gideon Rose is with us, editor of Foreign Affairs from New York, from Washington, Detroit News Bureau Chief there. David Shepherdson is with us. A lot of news made in his city this week. Jack Beatty is with us. Let's go to our listeners. Their story, South Hero, Vermont. Tom is calling. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
I was at the American Embassy, 72 to 74, and the political section.
In South Africa, Pretoria?
In Pretoria. Mm-hmm. And I was really shocked as I spoke to my predecessor, and this is relates to putting a point on the fact that the United States policies weren't where they should have been, and people need to remember that or know it. I was shocked to find out that the American ambassador had gone hunting with a South African government cabinet minister in a bird sanctuary that occupied one half of Robben Island. And as you know, the other half was the prison where Nelson Mandela was held.
For nearly 27 years, yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then the ambassador proceeded to serve the birds at a dinner for a visiting State Department official, and the hapless State Department official was the only one at the table who didn't know where the birds came from, and the South African government officials who were constituted the majority of those partaking in the dinner found it more than a little bit amusing.
What was the message to you, Tom, in the Foreign Service at that time in South Africa from the U.S. government? Could you, you know, were you in the streets with black South Africans? Were you in community with them or not?
I was able to in part because when I first got there, we weren't allowed to go in any black or colored or Indian township, any non-white area, without getting a pass from the South African government. And I went to the deputy chief of mission, the senior career person. We had a Nixon political appointee as our ambassador. And I said, I'm not applying for a pass. South Africans don't need permission to go anywhere in the U.S., and I'm just telling you, you know, if I get arrested, the embassy's just going to have to deal with it. And very shortly thereafter, the memo came down that we weren't applying for passes anymore. And as a result, I had free access throughout the country. I had a lot of black friends, including, I'm proud to say, Stephen Biko. Wow. And, was able to do a lot of things. And I will say that although I didn't get a heck of a lot of support from the embassy, they also didn't interfere. So,
Stephen Biko, who died long before his time in South Africa and brutally there, hard to imagine how much things changed later, but they did. Nelson Mandela, I guess, would be in prison for almost 20 more years after the times that you recount, Tom. I appreciate your call very much. You leave us with that image of the U.S. ambassador hunting on Robben Island where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned. Thank you for your call. Amy in Springfield, Massachusetts. Amy, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to, as you just spoke about, remind us all to remember not just the peace that Mr. Mandela brought, but the suffering that he endured in prison for many, many, many years, not knowing if he was ever going to get out. And it's a reminder for us all to not lose hope.
Amy, you're so right. You're so right. It's an incredible, incredible deep reminder of that. The fact that he could come out with the attitude he came out with. Gideon Rose, anybody who saw it will never forget when he walked out of prison in South Africa and the kind of buoyancy that he immediately radiated to the world when it could have been any attitude and the deepest scowl would have been deserved.
Well, I think that's when he became not just the champion of South African black independence and majority rule, but also a citizen of the world who showed all of us what we could be, what true humanity was. He became a truly global hero in the way that Gandhi was, in the way that King was. These are not the property of any one community, but the moral heritage of mankind.
I want to turn, we'll be thinking about Nelson Mandela right throughout the weekend and for a long, long time to come, I hope. But there's more news this week, and I want to turn to it. Economic news we'll look at. Unemployment down to around 7%. Good jobs numbers this month, and good GDP recently as well. Joe Biden in China this week, and in a really tricky dance there. China pushing its airspace territorial out over the East China Sea into disputed territory with Japan, a formal U.S. ally. This was Joe Biden in China on Thursday, talking with the American Chamber of Commerce there about China's new air defense zone over disputed waters. A little bit tough and a little bit careful. Here he is.
China's recent and sudden announcement of the establishment of a new air defense identification zone has, to state the obvious, caused significant apprehension in the region. And I was very direct about our firm position and our expectations in my conversations with President Xi. But I also put this in a broader context.
In a broader context. Let's not get too head up here. While he's in China, we heard him much tougher talking in South Korea. We don't recognize this zone. No effect. Zero. Ask my general. Gideon Rose, what about the Biden two-step in Beijing this week and the U.S. situation here?
Well, I think that's because there is a sort of multi-layered aspect to this. So the specific thing that China did was to announce what's called an air defense identification zone in the East China Sea. Now, this is something – the concept never occurred before the 1950s, and it was basically a product of the Cold War, and it was actually a positive thing. The idea was to reduce the possibility of surprise attack, to be able to avoid confrontations. People would essentially establish rules of the road for aircraft in various areas.
If you come near, let us know who you are, ID yourself,
exactly,
and we'll be fine. The U.S. immediately threw B-52s across without IDing, of course, because this goes to sovereignty as well.
Well, but see, it doesn't. That's the key thing, right?
Tell that to Japan, Gideon.
There's no international agreements governing any aspect of ADIZs. Nobody is explicitly authorized to establish them, nor are they explicitly prohibited from doing so. And there's no connection between ADIZs and sovereignty. So the idea that this was – they're usually sort of pragmatic, technocratic things to avoid sort of incidents in the air and things like that, or detect smuggling or things like that. The Chinese move clearly seems to be part of a broader attempt to nudge and press other countries in the region and establish sort of a forward presence over disputed islands and so forth, a part and parcel of China's broader strategy in the South China Sea. But it's a peculiarly odd kind of thing to have done because it doesn't actually help that and it doesn't give them any real purchase when it comes to the sovereignty question over the disputed islands. And all it does is make all the other countries like Japan and the Philippines and South Korea and Taiwan much more angry and ready to be partners with the United States in some sort of containment. So the challenge for Biden was, look, this thing really doesn't matter. On the other hand, you're not going to get the Chinese to walk it back completely because it'd be too humiliating. Somebody on the Chinese side screwed up. And so the challenge then is, how do you, in effect, tell them, look, we understand that it's going to be somewhat too humiliating for you to literally repeal it, but let's just essentially all agree that you're not going to enforce it, we're not going to recognize it, and try to move on as if this never happened. Sometimes when someone does something embarrassing in public, the smartest thing to do is to pretend not to notice, while at the same time making sure that Japan, Korea, Taiwan, the Philippines, and so forth, all of our allies and friends in the region understand that we're not going to let the Chinese essentially push us or them around.
Yeah, Gideon, so I've got to come in here. And you say nudge and press, and of course we know that in Tokyo and in Seoul, it's hardly seen as just nudging. You've got a very hot sovereignty dispute. This airspace is right over that. You call it somebody messed up. Well, we'll see. There's huge nationalist sentiment in China. And you could hear, to my ear, having spent many years in the region, Joe Biden walking very gingerly around this with China. He knows that sentiment as well. David Shepherdson, what about back in Washington? How is this being interpreted there? Is Washington setting the definition, the rules of what's going on here, or dancing with a powerful new counterpart across the Pacific?
Well, that's exactly the issue, right? I mean, and on the economic front, the U.S. is trying to negotiate a Trans-Pacific Partnership free trade deal with some of our, you know, critical Asian partners, you know, including Japan, as part of a counterweight toward Japan, toward China. And, you know, this is only one of a host of issues that the vice president is dealing with, where China is showing being more bold. He also raised the issue of that there's about two dozen Bloomberg and New York Times journalists that may be forced to leave China at the end of the year because the Chinese government has not renewed their visas to report in the country. So, no, I think in Congress, in Washington, there is a growing sense of concern that China, you know, the fastest growing economy, you know, in the world, is a growing strategic, you know, sort of flexing its muscles and showing that it's willing to be more aggressive in asserting its territorial claims on not just these islands but throughout the region. And you know, there was one Chinese scholar that sort of compared it to the United States and the Monroe Doctrine, you know, almost two centuries ago,
yeah,
when China's trying to basically show that they are the dominant player in Asia, and the U.S. is trying to use the economic, military, and diplomatic tools it has as a counterweight to that.
And that has been put very much right in the face of American journalists in China, having a lot of trouble keeping their visas, moving around as they might like, being able to cover China in a rich, full way that you might expect of such a major power. Biden spoke to that yesterday in China.
We have many disagreements, and some profound disagreements, on some of those issues right now, the treatment of U.S. journalists. But I believe China will be stronger and more stable and more innovative if it respects universal human rights.
Jack Beattie, what do you see in this back and forth between Beijing and Washington with Joe Biden right in the middle this week?
Well, I was glad to see Biden shift from crisis stoking to crisis cooling. I mean, I think the rhetoric, I don't know if it came directly from him in Japan or from the administration, but the Obama administration did say, quote, that it would back Japan in any war over these islands. Wait a minute. Support Japan in a war over these rock piles in the empty sea?
We've got a treaty, Jack. We've got a long relationship. They demilitarized and we wrote their peace constitution. That has been the deal.
Well, I understand, but what a way to put it when you're going to deal with the immutable giant there of China. And luckily, once he was in Beijing, in Japan, he was talking about, well, they have to roll this back. That's gone. They don't have to roll it back. We're not in a position to dictate to them. And from what I read in Nick Kristof, it's not clear really whose islands these are. The Japanese say they have them. The Chinese, who knows what the claims are. are. But you know, to anyone with who grew up in the 50s, it brought back memories of Quemoy and Matsu, yeah, and all the struggles over those islands,
Taiwan
and
of course, Straits,
and the Taiwan Straits, and of course Taiwan itself. And you know, we don't want to set any precedents that would weaken our defense, quote unquote, of Taiwan. But on the other hand, we don't want to make rash statements about going to war over rock piles.
We'll be watching this one for decades as the United States and the immediate neighbors in Asia deal with China's rising power. In Detroit, power may be headed in the other direction, or at least kind of a new deal there, a judge clearing the way for bankruptcy in Detroit, which would go at, among other things, public pensions. Here was Judge Stephen Rhodes, U.S. bankruptcy judge for the Eastern District of Michigan, on Tuesday as he ruled in favor of Detroit's filing for Chapter 9 bankruptcy. He called the filing sad, but a hopeful sign for the city's future.
This once proud and prosperous city can't pay its debts. It's insolvent. It's eligible for bankruptcy. At the same time, it also has an opportunity for a fresh start.
David Shepardson, you're with the Detroit News. How is Detroit taking this on board? The opportunity side being hailed, or the, what about our public pension side being bemoaned, or both?
It's definitely both. You know, as you played in the Judge Rhodes clip, Detroit was once one of the wealthiest, most productive cities in the United States. It was the fourth largest city in the 1920s. It was the seat of industrial might and had tens of thousands of factories and hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs. It was a huge center of the U.S. economy.
And that's a lot of was in one paragraph.
That's right. And since in the last 50 years, the city has shed more than 1 million people, hundreds of thousands of jobs, and it really has become a national tragedy. You know, 80,000 abandoned buildings, 60 to 70% of streetlights that don't work, police that don't show up, ambulances that don't work, a city that simply is largely dysfunctional. And so,
is the presumption now that public pensions will in fact be cut? I know there's an appeal planned, I think I'm reading here, but barring that, and how much of a cut, and what kind of precedent this in the same week that Illinois is also struggling with big public pension obligations?
So of the $18.5 billion in debt and long-term liabilities the city has, about half of that is pensions and health care. $3.5 billion are unfunded pension liabilities. So the police and fire pension fund is roughly 97% funded. So we don't know the extent of the cuts. There will almost certainly be cuts proposed, along with cuts to bondholders, in order to get to this plan of adjustment to wipe out most of that debt. But it is not clear precisely how much, and the final decision will certainly be made by the appeals courts, potentially the Supreme Court, because it is a problem throughout the country. You have, you know, trillions of dollars of unfunded pensions, promises made by cities and counties and states across this country that were simply not funded properly, and governments put off making the hard choices to pay those bills and put the money aside. And in Illinois, they have $100 billion pension liability. The governor's just signed sweeping legislation that will save the state about $160 billion in payments over the next 30 years, but it will require cuts to pension recipients. And then cities like Chicago are up next. Chicago has a $20 billion pension liability, and the mayor there warns that they could have to raise property taxes by at least 40% to address that without more cuts. So this is a problem. It's not just Detroit. The rest of the country is facing
the country. And Mayor Rahm Emanuel, among others, facing that. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, on Saturday, a college football finish for the ages as Auburn beat Alabama in epic style. Here's Rod Bramblett, the voice of Auburn football, with the call of a lifetime.
Chris Davis takes it to the back of the end zone. He'll run it out to the 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 45. There goes Davis.
Oh, my God.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game. Auburn's going to win the football game.
Just crazy. Nobody who saw that will ever forget it. Tough winter weather moving in this week across much of the nation. Even California. Here's citrus grower Nancy Garrison in San Jose. She's using heat lamps to try to save her crop.
If it gets into the 20s and I don't do any kind of protection, then the fruit that's developing on the citrus and the avocados will be ruined.
And the temperatures have dropped. And last night, NBC put on a new live version of the classic show, The Sound of Music, with Carrie Underwood as Maria. Mixed reviews.
The hills are alive with the sound of music.
Oh, boy. We're looking at a week in the news. Biden in China, pensions and Detroit, a train off the rails in the world, remembering, honoring Nelson Mandela. Gideon Rose is with us, editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. David Shepherdson's here, Washington Bureau chief for the Detroit News. Jack Beatty's here as well. Here's the sound of a Mexican official. That was some story. A truck with a lot of cobalt-60 on it, radioactive material used in cancer treatments, headed for a storage facility. And it was stolen. This is Mardonino Jimenez Rojas, an official from Mexico's National Nuclear Safety Commission, before it was recovered, telling Euronews it could be dangerous.
Only if inadvertently or intentionally the thieves open the magnetic head to take out the material is there a very, very serious radioactive risk.
We've got a lot to look at here, but Gideon Rose, let's make clear, they did retrieve it, they do have it, but there was a while there where it felt like that could be dirty bomb material floating around almost anywhere, Gideon.
Yeah, you know, it's actually, there's an old joke about, you know, if we ever have a nuclear bomb in the U.S., how's it going to get into the country? And someone joked, you know, it's going to be smuggled in a bale of marijuana. There's a lot of not just traffic coming from the south, but a lot of legal and illegal stuff. And in this case, it was, you know, not so much illegal. Look, this is part and parcel, frankly, of the ever-increasing integration of North America. And it's something that's an interesting story, but it's not something I would get hugely all head up about. I mean, look, we're in the 20th anniversary of NAFTA this year, coming up. And it's actually a really interesting time to think about the positive effects that integration has achieved, particularly in Mexico, probably somewhat in the U.S., somewhat in Canada, but the strides that Mexico has taken and the increase in connection economically and otherwise across North America is actually a good thing. So I'm not particularly bothered by this.
Your equanimity
story
is wonderful, and but there was a moment there where I have to say, I don't know, Jack, David, I was worried that the next thing we'd hear was watch out Los Angeles. I mean, after all, this cargo came out of Tijuana, just across the border.
And it sort of sounded like the start of a Batman movie, didn't it?
But yes.
There is a more serious point, which is that, you know, the IAEA reports, you know, there's about 20 stolen cases of theft every year of radioactive material around the world. So, you know, when you consider the vast amount of nuclear radioactive material that potentially could be used for, you know, for harm, that's controlled by so many countries, many of them not entirely stable, it is, you know, it's troubling. And, you know, it's one of the things that, you know, it's a constant fear when you live in the nuclear age, right? This is something that, you know, is a real risk.
Don't want to think about it. Have to think about it. At least this week we had to think about it. Another thing you don't want to think about, trains going off the rails. Wednesday, it was reported that William Rockefeller, no less, the engineer in charge of the Metro North train that went off the tracks on Sunday in New York, was in a daze at the controls. His union rep, Anthony Bartolico, said Rockefeller had admitted to zoning out.
He zoned out. He had one of those where, whoa, you know, like, you know, you drive your car and, you know, you stare at the same thing for so long, and, you know, he zoned, and he caught himself, but he caught himself too late.
Jack Beatty, this was weirdly kind of a relief. I mean, you hate to think of the train's engineer zoning out, and we hear that the fail-safe brake was at the other end of the train, I guess, because he was maybe pushing it from behind. But somehow it was better than hearing that this was an infrastructure collapse.
Yes. one can deal with human foibles, but we want our infrastructure to be proof against that. And, you know, we have seen infrastructure collapses in the past. And, yeah, there was a comfort in knowing, well, it was just zoning out. Of course, people died.
I want to go to the big story on healthcare, healthcare.gov. The deadline for getting that site fixed up, the Obama administration said, the end of October, November 1st. That came and went just after Thanksgiving Day. And the White House was claiming a kind of, if not far from fully fixed, but a kind of victory here. This was the top Obama administration, Jeff Zients, on Sunday, talking with reporters in a conference call, saying night and day to what it was in its really lousy October 1st rollout.
The bottom line, healthcare.gov on December 1st is night and day from where it was on October 1st.
Okay, the volume the site is handling is indeed way up. Republicans, though, still going at it. This was Wednesday at a House Oversight Committee meeting. A Republican congressman from Texas, Kevin Brady, saying the problems with the Affordable Care Act go beyond the website.
The Affordable Care Act's fundamental problem can't be fixed with better marketing. The flaw is not the website. The flaw is the law itself. Improving the defective website won't make Obamacare premiums more affordable. Improving the defective website won't prevent millions of Americans from walking to their mailbox only to find the health care plan they have and like is canceled.
David Shepardson in Washington, how about it? Did it feel this week like the Affordable Care Act and healthcare.gov were pulling themselves out of the woods here? Or is the Republican attack still sharp and likely to be effective in the pushback? How do you read the weather on this front?
Certainly, the administration is doing far better from a PR standpoint. The website is working far better. They have released some enrollment numbers that are much stronger, albeit still not as high as they need to get to the numbers of enrollees by the end of the year. But I think the jury's out in terms of whether the Republican attacks will be successful long term, and really this is something that's probably going to get addressed in the November midterm elections, and you're going to see the Democrats hammer the idea of what is the Republican alternative. Do they want to repeal all of the very positive parts? But, you know, clearly there's an enormous hand-wringing on the part of the Democrats for the terrible self-inflicted wounds that the administration caused itself by rolling out a clearly not ready website on October 1st when they certainly could have delayed that site if they had a more realistic idea of how poorly it would operate in the first 2 months.
Yeah, easy to say now, but there was plenty of heat on to get it out there and get it going at the time. Let's hear from our listeners. Joseph, Williamsburg, Virginia. Joseph, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, I was wondering if, in fact, the ACA is repealed after the next presidential, is there a mechanism to still, or will there be a mechanism to still maintain certain aspects of it, mainly the pre-existing condition one?
Certain aspects, could they be saved even if another president tried to dismantle it? Why do you ask, Joseph? Do you have a particular interest?
Yeah, I have cancer.
And so if you lost your coverage, getting coverage again without this, I don't know, have you tried without it, without the ACA?
I have coverage at the moment.
Yeah.
It's eventualities. I mean,
yeah.
You know, you worry about it.
Of course, like, you do.
You know, I think everyone else's.
Yeah, absolutely. Jack, what about it? First of all, can you imagine an electoral turn where it's actually repealed? And if it's repealed, what about a piecemeal saving of elements that a lot of people are going to be very loath to give up, like don't bar me from insurance if I have a pre-existing condition? Many do.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to imagine it being repealed politically. Even if the Republicans won the presidency and the Congress, they would have to take things back from people. They'd have to take back the millions, 19 million people now under Medicaid, they'd have to take back those benefits. They'd have to take back all the subsidies to other Americans, and these are in the millions. Almost an insuperable task politically. It would set off such reaction. So I just don't think, I think if this thing goes, you know, for a year or even 6 months, some people think, it is beyond repeal politically, much as they might want to do it in a policy terms. It just doesn't seem on. And then in policy terms, you know, the professor, the people that look at this say these things all hang together. You can't take pre-existing conditions out without also dealing with the expansion of the market that the subsidies create. You know, what allows the insurance companies to say, okay, we won't do pre-existing conditions is all those new people coming in buying insurance.
Yeah. Pull out a Jenga piece.
I think that's actually key, which is the you can't actually break up the different components, because the pre-existing conditions it will bankrupt the insurance companies if you don't have a very large market of healthy people as well. So you have to make it the individual mandate. But then if you add community rating, which covers the pre-existing conditions, and the individual mandate, there are going to be a lot of people who are too poor to afford health care. So you end up with the subsidies for the low-income people. But if you add together the community rating, individual mandate, and subsidies, you know, as Kevin Drum has said, that's about 90% of what Obamacare actually is. And so you can't pick out the good parts and not have the bad parts. And that's why I think the Republicans are fighting a losing battle, because they're not going to want to be able to repeal the bad part, the good parts, and yet they hang together with the bad parts.
It's a race against time there, which explains some of the real fervor to jump on it fast, I guess, if you're opposed. Michelle in Westminster, West Vermont. Thanks for calling, Michelle. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that my husband and I signed up. Well, we're in Vermont, so we have our own website, so we have not been inconvenienced.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But we are now saving $500 a month, and I don't hear this story very often on the media. And I'd also just like to say that it seems to me that most of what we do here about basically is an inconvenience. We've got something historical and astonishing happen right here, and I think it's, you know, a lot of people feel it's absolutely the right thing to do. So I'd like to hear that reported more, and the stories about people for whom it's working so well.
Michelle, we've got it. There's a big thumbs up from Michelle and her household, and of course many others signing up as well. Those numbers, in a way, speak for themselves. But it bears saying. There they are. President Obama giving a speech this week. This was at the Center for American Progress. Talking about inequality, talking about American opportunities, saying he wants to devote much of the remainder of his time in office to addressing those two. Here he was pointing to the problem in American mobility, opportunity, moving up, the president.
The fact is this, the opportunity gap in America is now as much about class as it is about race, and that gap is growing. So if we're going to take on growing inequality and try to improve upward mobility for all people, we've got to move beyond the false notion that this is an issue exclusively of minority concern.
Jack Beatty, he talked broadly about opportunity for all Americans and then turned to this issue saying, well, don't think this is just a racial issue. This cuts right across lines. Where do you see the president turning here? It's not the first speech he's given on this front, but it was a kind of big statement that got maybe a little bit lost in all the other news this week, Jack.
I agree. I mean, it was his third speech on inequality, and in some ways the most important because, as you say, he said class. He used the word class barriers. That is to say, heritable disadvantage based upon what your parents do in life. That seems almost un-American to talk that way. What do you mean, class barriers? Mm. And that's what we're facing in America. You know, we're facing the prospect of inequality being to the American future what mobility was to the American past, frozen class stasis. And the president said, this isn't America. This has to change. And, you know, he really, I think, has done something very important here. The subject of politics is now, or at least Democratic politics, is inequality, and what are you going to do about it? Hillary Clinton, who has more centrist inclinations, will have to respond to it, and eventually the Republicans will have to respond to it. Their platform in 2008 didn't mention it, nor in 2012. What's their program? Do they concede the problem? What is their answer? The Democrats have all sorts of answers, whether they're possible or not or would make things better or not is another question. But at least the president is coming out with his litany of the minimum wage and earned income tax credit and early childhood education and all the rest. And eventually, as he says, let's see what the Republicans say.
David Shepardson, we've seen the pickets at fast food outlets, McDonald's and more this week. We've seen them at Walmart around Thanksgiving time about minimum wage. We can't live on this. What about the GOP view of that movement? Look to address it or step around it? Or what's the response?
Their response has been basically against government spending and the argument that sort of lower taxes, a better economic climate, rising tide lifts all boats. Mm-hmm. But there is not a real, addressing on the part of the Republican Party about the fact that the top 10%, as the president said, 30 years ago controlled about a third of the wealth. Now it's half of the country's wealth, and that as productivity gains have been very dramatic in the last 30 years, the wages have been flat or declined. And so the middle class is struggling. Unemployment is still a very large problem, even though it is 7% and the country added 200,000 jobs. There are states like Michigan are still at 9%. And there's a lot of people either without work or with low-wage jobs and seemingly no way out from that cycle of poverty, and which is why I think you see, these protests about the fact that there aren't any real immediate pushes to find ways to raise wages, and unfortunately, there's a stalemate here in Washington. So don't look for any legislation, unfortunately, probably till there's another election.
A new set of challenges, at least in scale. Movement in those economic numbers this week. Let's hope they continue to go in a good direction, but who knows where that heads. And all of us remembering, honoring Nelson Mandela in this week as we look at all the news. Grateful to the three of you for being with us. David Shepardson with the Detroit News, Washington Bureau Chief joining us today. David, thank you very much and good luck to your city.
Thanks, Tom. We appreciate it.
Gideon Rose with Foreign Affairs joining us today out of New York. Thank you so much, Gideon.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.